This is an MUT Radio podcast.
Hello, I'm Dr. Amalia Gonyas-Malka. Welcome to Womanity, Woman in Unity, the show that celebrates women's milestone achievements in their struggle for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, democracy, and much more. Today, we welcome the Swedish ambassador to South Africa, Anna Karin Annerström, and she has a career that spans the United Nations, the European Union, as well as senior leadership roles in Sweden's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And in this conversation, we will explore Ambassador Annerström's journey, as well as some of her insights into the world of diplomacy. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Ambassador, you hold a distinguished career with posts in the UN as well as the EU and multiple senior leadership roles in Sweden's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Looking back, what was the inspiration to pursue a career in diplomacy? And was there kind of a trigger or defining moment that put you on this trajectory?
Yes, it was actually so. I'm a lawyer by training, and when I studied the law, I was very much focused on becoming a lawyer in court. But when I started with international law, I got in contact with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Stockholm, and I was very inspired by these contacts. And since they actually needed lawyers at the ministry, they encouraged me to apply for the diplomatic training program. So I did. At the moment, I was already working in a court as an intern, but I then finished that and started in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And I've been there 30 years ago, and I'm still there.
I imagine in these types of positions, no 2 days are ever the same. So it's a constant change.
It is. It is. And that's the challenge, and that's the beauty of this profession.
And thinking about some of that diversity, you served in Sweden's permanent. You served as Sweden's permanent representative to the United Nations, and previously as special advisor on digitalization to the president of the UN General Assembly. So tapping into those types of roles, what leadership lessons from the UN do you carry across into your ambassadorship in South Africa?
I think a couple. I think the importance of listen to others when you work in the UN context. You're not only working with one or two or three countries, you're working with 192 other countries. And that makes it very important to listen, to build good relationships with, because many times it's about personal relationships. You come from different countries with different positions, but you also build personal relationships with your colleagues. I think you need also to accept that there are differences. We come from different cultures. We come from different positions. But it's how can we build that sort of common ground together? And I think one of the most important tools that I have had as a Swedish diplomat in the UN system is international law. And this is something that we should all agree on. So that could be a sort of a basis for finding common ground, even if we don't always share the common positions.
I was going to ask you, how did you look towards having a sort of benchmark that guides that? Because you're so right, there are multiple cultures in place. And to be collaborative, if you have a kind of anchor as a true north, then that helps with decisioning. Otherwise, it could be very fragmented.
Yes, and I think international law, and that's very, I think for most diplomats, that is really what we build our positions on. And as a Swedish diplomat, this is really important. It's not only important for sort of from a moral point of view as a moral sort of way of looking at things, but it's also extremely important from a security point of view, because as a country, we also build our security policy on the fact that we need to have member states fulfilling international law. If they violate international law, as we see now in the world, then we run into also security problems.
Can you share with us a couple of important landmarks in your career that stand out for you?
Yes, I think, I mean, my first ambassadorial post, of course, in Islamabad and also covering Afghanistan, I think is one of those, which was a challenge, but also a very important point in my career. So was my appointment as Director General for Political Affairs, which is the highest civil servant in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And then my post as permanent representative in New York, which actually was my dream post. So I'm very happy to and honored to have served as the Swedish permanent representative in New York.
These roles are not just, I would say, enticing from the point of view of the work that you do, but it also gives you this incredible opportunity of experiencing the world. You've traveled everywhere.
Almost.
Was serving in Africa part of your wish list?
Yes, very much so. So I served in Kenya, Nairobi, Kenya. It was my second post, and I think it taught me two things. First, it really created my love for this continent, and that's something that I've kept in my heart ever since. It's also where I learned the to really engage in the multilateral field, because I was covering, as you know, Nairobi is the host of a UN headquarters, the only one in a developing country, and I was responsible for the UN issues there, and I really sort of learned to be really interested and see the importance of working together with other countries. I'm really happy to be back in South Africa on the African continent.
And reflecting on your current role as ambassador, what are some of the objectives that you want to accomplish in your term?
I think, I mean, as an ambassador, you always want to strengthen the relationship with your own country and the country in which you work. And that is, of course, my objective here as well. There are very strong links between historical links between Sweden and many of the countries in this region. And I want to build on these and enhance our relationship even further, thereby also pursuing the Swedish interest in foreign and security policy. I think here you look into some of the countries, especially South Africa, that plays a very important regional role and a very important global role. So I want to enhance that dialogue. I think the multilateral field, we very much share the importance of multilateralism, which is challenged right now. And then, of course, there are other areas very important to also work with the Swedish companies that are here. So increase the trade between our two countries. And then we work in areas like education, and we also have a regional program for sexual and reproductive health and rights, which is our development cooperation agency CEDA works with from South Africa, but covering the entire African continent. So these are some of the areas that I will focus on.
Can you unpack for us a little bit more about the education programs and also the sexual reproductive rights programs? And I ask that because of us being a gender-based program and that these are core areas that touch women.
So on the education, it's on the university level. So we have a very good cooperation between several Swedish universities and many of the South African universities. It's called the Sweden South Africa University Forum, SASUF. South Africa Sweden University Forum, SASUF. And it's really an excellent exchange of research and studies between a range of universities in both countries. It also gives us here in South Africa a possibility to interact regularly with the students at the universities in South Africa. So we have something that we call Sweden on the Road, which is a way of us reaching out and visiting different universities in South Africa. I've only been here 3 months, so I've only visited one university in Port Elizabeth, in Nelson Mandela University. And coming back to what we discussed before on the importance of interaction with youth, I think this was really, really important. And also to explain from our side what Sweden stands for, what opportunities there are actually for also studying in Sweden, but also sort of discussing where are we on a range of issues, including some of the global issues. So I think that's a very important part of our activities. And I think speaking to youth is something that's so rewarding and important. And then on the sexual and reproductive health and right, that is a program, it's a regional program that's based in Pretoria. We have a section in the embassy from our development cooperation agency, CEDA, and they cover the entire continent. And of course, I think we agree on the basic right for all women to decide over their own bodies. And this is what this program is very much about. That is, of course, a basic right for everyone. That is so important also for women to, if they can decide over themselves, they can also then engage very much in other parts of the society. And gender-based violence is a part of this. We might come back to that issue. We are entering the 16 days against gender-based violence. And of course, we know from this country and many other countries what a huge problem this is for many, many women.
Let's talk for a moment on the issue of gender-based violence and the fact that we are going into 16 days of activism against gender-based violence, which is it's an international campaign kicking off on the 25th of November and fittingly International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women. And it runs until the 10th of December, so closing with the UN Human Rights Day. And this year's theme is Unite to End Digital Violence Against Women and Girls. And I think it's so telling that we have to protect ourselves or require protection, not just from physical violence, but also online violence and how this is increasingly becoming an issue. In your opinion, what would you say makes this campaign significant and impactful?
I mean, as you said, it is an international campaign. We were very much engaged also at the UN in New York, from the Swedish side, from the EU side, and together with other countries. I think this is, of course, heinous acts that we need to act against. The most important thing is that we do not only do campaigns, but that we see results on the ground, and that will require, of course, not only us as international or national or women and men and women engaged in these campaigns, but it means that we need to see results from those that can take decisions. You need legislation, of course. You need engagement from government and other agencies. You need the police to act. You need the prosecutors to take these men, usually men, to court. They need to be tried in court, and they need to be accountable for their acts. You need to work with women, safe houses for women and for their children. And I think we need to, which is already here, of course, to build these networks that is needed for women to support each other. But I think you raised and this year's campaign is focused on the digital side and the violence, the technology facilitated violence against women. I had the honor to lead process in New York on the Global Digital Compact, which is a really broad compact on all different kinds of cooperation when it comes to the digital field. Of course, the violence against women, girls, and children was a very, very important part of that. And this is, of course, a responsibility of governments, But it's also huge responsibilities for the tech companies to see to it that they safeguard the space for women. This is difficult, but it's really key. And of course, I think us as parents, we also have a responsibility when it comes to, I have a daughter and she's very much online, but I think that responsibility from us as parents is also a key one, of course.
In our conversation, we've talked about, would say, some of the governance aspects and the legal aspects within the digital element of protecting against violence. But given your insights in the work in this field, is there anything that women can do proactively to defend or prevent acts from occurring to them?
You mean not only on online, but also broader
Broader.
than.
So yes, because it's just almost try and move away from a little bit of a victim mentality, but of coming up and confronting so that you protect yourself and potentially others.
I think the pressure that we need to make on those that on the decision makers is a really important part of that. And for us to be able to do that, we need to work together. Women from different strands of life needs to come together to put pressure on governments to act on this. And of course, having our representatives also in the governments. It can be a man, it can be a woman, but it's very important that we influence the decision makers. And then I think it is, as we have always come back to, we need to use these networks that we have for women coming together. And we need to work with men. This is not only a female issue, this is an issue for the entire society. And I think also the way that we need to build this confidence in the younger generation, I think is really important as well. And to make everyone understand that violence is totally unacceptable, and that the first sign of being affected by violence will need to leave that relationship. I think that's that confidence we need to build in the younger generations. So working together, I always quote Madeleine Albright, the former US Secretary of State, when she says that there is a place in hell for women not helping each other. I think this is something really important, but we need also to work with men. I think that is important. And I mean, research really show that boys coming from an environment where they have seen violence against their mothers or sisters, they are prone to also e more easily come into relationship, but that is an element. So we really need to work with boys and men on this.
It's a multifaceted challenge, and as you say, it's a combination of working across the gender spectrum, men, women, boys, girls together. Sweden consistently ranks among the most gender equal countries in the world. From your perspective, what are some of the core principles or policies that drive the success? And then secondly, what lessons could be relevant for other countries to take away and learn from?
I'm always pointing at two things that happened when we were actually, from an economic point of view, we needed women to come out on the labor market. The first one was free childcare for every child over the year of one, which was the legislation that came into force already in the 70s in Sweden. The second one was to separate the taxation between the spouses. So before that legislation, if Usually, the woman wanted to come out on the labor market. Her salary would put on top of the men's salary, which means that in a high taxation country like Sweden, you would really get very little money back because a lot would go into taxes. So that was, I think, these two legislations were really, really key for, I mean, first, you need to have someone taking care of your children if you are working. And the second, then, that there is an incentive to actually earn your own money. And I think we come back to maybe the importance of economic empowerment, which I really think is one of the key basic things for the larger issue of women's empowerment. I would add another one as well, which is, and coming back to the childcare, is an equal responsibility for a family. I think, I mean, I think it's probably the same in South Africa, which was the case, and in some cases still the case in Sweden, that women, when they start to build a family, they would tend to stay home to a larger extent than men. So I think that is also very important. I mean, we have a system where we have a parental leave for staying at home the first time, year actually with children in Sweden. We don't have the maternity leave, we have parental leave. So that equal responsibility for the family, I think, is key. As is, of course, all legislation that would not permit women to be laid off because of pregnancies. And that is, of course, a key for continue to be on the labor market.
It's so interesting, all of these points, and the fact that thinking about the free childcare that was already established in the 70s, that's 50 years ago of being ahead of the curve, because it's such an essential part of allowing you as an individual, as a woman, to go forward into the career world. And I think the other things that you've mentioned for me really underscores the importance of legislation and law, that when you have these elements in place, it's about being progressive and benefiting society.
Yes, I think it's really important, and I'm also coming back to the fact that this is, of course, something that has to do with that we want to support the empowerment of women, but it's actually also an economic incentive for societies. I mean, we as women, we are 50% of the population. There is actually no country in the world that cannot fully utilize 50% of its population. So this is an economic this is also an economic sort of driving force for societies to actually get women out on the labor market.
100%. And can you tell us about a couple of women in Sweden who've been important change agents?
I mean, I would start with the women authors, teachers, doctors that actually were the driving force between the right of women to vote in the 19 in the beginning of the 1920s. I think they really made the way for many of us afterwards, and one of them also made the first women entering the parliament in Sweden. So I think that was. They paved the way for many of the things that happened afterwards, because as we had discussed before, you need to have women in power in order to change things. I mean, for me personally, I would also point at Agda Rössel, who was actually the first ever female permanent representative in at the UN in New York. She was Swedish. And she was there, she started in 1958 and as the first ever from any country female permanent representative. She was also very engaged in FGM already in the 50s and the 60s. So someone to work as a role model for many of us.
You mentioned early in the conversation that one of your first posts was in Islamabad. And I think that has to be a challenging environment, especially for a woman. So working in conflict regions such as Afghanistan and Pakistan. It must have given you some tremendous insights in terms of the genderized, or let's say the gendered realities of peace and security. Can you tell us how those experiences taught you about the role of women in peace building and also political stability?
Yes, I think, I mean, I was so impressed by many of the women I met both in Pakistan and in Afghanistan. Of course, very different contexts in these two in these two countries. But in Pakistan, very many women organized and active in the political sphere, both in the parliament. Of course, there's been a very strong female prime minister in Pakistan, in Benazir Bhutto, and how they sort of also pushed reforms through the Pakistani society. I think in Afghanistan, it's what women did there for the development, both the economic development and the political de development, is very courageous, and it's extremely sad to see what's happening now, and of course we have a horrendous situation for women in Afghanistan, and it's just very sad to see. And I met many of these women that I met in Afghanistan when I worked there. I met them outside, and of course they're doing whatever they can to try to influence the situation there, but it's very, very difficult. But these women, of course, play key roles when it comes to stability and peace. And I think we always need to work for having more women participating in the peace accords, in the negotiations for peace, in the implementation of peace. And we know that that will make peace much more sustainable. And I have another example as well, because I was head of the Peace Building Commission's configuration for Liberia when I was in New York. And I think that is a really, really good example on you see where you see how women pushed for the peace accord, how they were very much part of the implementation of the peace accord, and how they now are so engaged in the continued and strengthening of the democracy in Liberia. So I think these are good examples on how we see that women have worked for peace. And in the case of Afghanistan, it was not sustainable because it was taken over by a regime who do not respect that. In Liberia, we see a different development.
I have to say that when I look at Afghanistan, it really hurts. And this idea that all of the effort, all of the work that's been done can actually unravel in our lifetime, it really is a tragedy for me. And I don't know what the solution is, but I do hope that something comes out of it and that there isn't a continual regression. Ambassador, you've highlighted the aspects of peacekeeping, political elements with women and the work that they do both in the three nations that you spoke about. And we really believe that building female leadership capacity is important for the future of women to the world, whether they're occupying roles in government as heads of state, demonstrating empowerment of women, that this kind of role modeling effect, and that if we have got suitable gender representation, that we end up with the right type of policy development and policy implementation. I recall reading back in 2021 that four out of the five Nordic countries had female prime ministers of Sweden, Denmark, Iceland, Finland. In contrast to Africa, we've had very, very few female presidents and prime ministers serving the continent. What type of elements do you think need to happen for more countries to accept a female president or prime minister?
It's a very interesting question. I think in gender equality are many times a matter of power, and I think it's you need a sort of a change of mindset and acceptance of that gender equality is very important for the country, and that is a process. But I think also, as we have discussed, that you need to have women that pave the way for others to join that route. So I think if you have strong women that come up in politics and show that what female leadership is about and how important it is with shared leadership between men and women, I think then the acceptance for a female leader is much much easier to build. I think in our countries, because we work with gender equality for a very long time, it's easier. So, but Magdalena Andersson is actually the only female prime minister we have had. I think we also that's you can. Of course, Sweden is very advanced and progressive when it comes to gender equality, but that tells that we still have a way to go, as all countries. I think this is a constant development and evolution that we need to continue to act for.
You've had a fantastic career in diplomacy, and you've shared some of these dynamics with you. And on top of this, which we haven't really spoken about, is that you've done this while raising a family. And I'd like it if you could take a few moments to share with young women who may aspire to roles in leadership, in diplomacy, or global affairs, and at the same time have a family. On how you've done it, and if you've got any words of advice for them.
Yeah, it's. I think the most important part for me is that I've had a partner and a husband who has been a partner. He's also working. He's also a diplomat, and that we have taken equal responsibility for the family. Sometimes I think he has taken even more responsibility, and that is of course something that has been extremely important for our entire family. So we have always moved around as a family, and the importance of having the children as part of that, even if there has been some hardship on them. I think the way that you, it's not either or, it's both. You don't need to avoid building a family because you want to pursue a career as a diplomat. I mean, you need to find that balance, and that's important. This is something that I would really encourage everyone from an early stage to do. There needs to be a balance in life with the between the professional side and the private side. This is easy to say; it's very difficult to do in reality because some of these, especially if you're a diplomat abroad, there are things that come with the job outside the working hours, like professional dinners and lunches and then breakfasts, which will take away time from your family. But I think you always need to devote time. If it's not during the weeks, it should be on during the weekends. And I always try to have dinner with my children and then maybe work later on afterwards if that's necessary. So I think yeah, it is really important. My son said something when we were in Islamabad and the security situation was really difficult. We were sitting in my bulletproof car, and he asked me the question. He was about 6 years old. He asked me the question, said, "Why are we diplomats?" He didn't say, "Why are you a diplomat?" He said, "Why are we diplomats?" And I think it's a very fair question because they are, of course, part of everything that happens. They are part of the fantastic opportunities that they will have as children living in different cultures and getting friends from all over the world. But the hardships of that is you leave your friends, you live in difficult circumstances, and you move around. There is a there is a concept of third culture kids, and I think this is probably good, something that well describes that how many of the children to diplomats feel when they are moving around a lot. And there are advantages, certainly with that, there are also some disadvantages.
But you make it work for you as the family unit. And
Yes.
I also think that sometimes people have in this, and it's a little unfair of saying work-life balance, 50% work, 50% home life. It's the reality is it's not that, but you find a method that works for you where you have the quality, not necessarily the quantity.
I think that's important, and as I said, I really want to re-emphasize that going into diplomacy or whatever sort of profession that is a demanding profession is not to choose that life without a family. I think it's as you said, it's like you make. I mean, I've made my way, and there are other ways, of course, of making this work family balance work and if you also sort of know that you go into that profession with the sort of understanding that this needs to be combined with my private, whatever private life that is. It might be friends, it might be family, it might be kids, but it doesn't matter. You need to have that sort of, you need to decide that from the beginning. And I think one thing that actually happened to me on my first day when I was at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Stockholm, there was one of the older diplomats that came down to us that just started, and I think, you know, they wanted to say that this life is not an easy life. So he told us about when he saw his son taking the plane from I don't know which country he was in, sending him at the age of six, seven, eight to a boarding school in Sweden. And I just decided then that if I ever have children, I would not like to do that. It works for some. It works really, really well for some. I am not saying that this is not an option, but for me, I felt very strongly that if I'm going to go into this career, and if I will have a family, because I didn't at that time, I would like to have them with me.
And I think that's also another important insight that in you set the tone. You can navigate. There isn't a cookie cutter solution. It's not a this or that. You manage your world on your own terms. Ambassador, we are unfortunately running out of time. As we close out today, can I please ask you to use this platform to share a few words of motivation or inspiration to women and girls that are listening to us on the continent.
Yes, I think the important thing is always to be yourself, to do what you feel is you, and to build your dreams on that. And of course, I would encourage everyone to live their dreams, and to do that in the way that suits them, to have the courage to dare taking steps that might not be, you might not feel safe and secure all the time, but to have that courage to try to realize what you want to do in life, and also to change your direction as I did. I mean, as I said in the beginning, my career was meant to be something totally different, and it was a very uncertain moment when I sort of stepped out of my more secure bubble to do something else. But there is always an opportunity to change and to try to realize your dreams.
Thank you for that wonderful message. It's been a pleasure having you on the show today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
You have been listening to Womanity, Woman in Unity, and we have been talking to the Swedish ambassador to South Africa, Anna Karin Enestrom.
This is an MUT Radio podcast.